Start, okay. This is David Hassman, and I'm here with Director General Mubusun Simang from the Department of Home Affairs at the Pertia Hotel in Midrand. So I wanted to start by asking you a bit about your background and the jobs that brought you to being Director General at the Department of Home Affairs.
My background might shock you. I was born 68 years ago, when I was at university, South Africa was in turmoil, and I was one of the people who left the country to go and prepare to fight against apartheid using war if necessary. I was a member of the African National Congress. Eventually, I spent 30 years in exile out of South Africa, involved both in the political struggle and in military struggles against the regime and other regimes in Southern Africa, such as the Rhodesian one. But eventually it was nice that we were able to come back home for me in 1993, fully 30 years after I'd been out of the country. So that's my background. I did, while I was abroad, attend university in Zambia, where I did a BSc, majoring in entomology and biochemistry. Before then, I had studied in South Africa at Fort Hare, but my studies were interrupted when I had to go to prepare for the liberation of the country. I did an MBA also with the U.S. International University, San Diego, but I used the Nairobi, Kenya campus for my studies. I majored in project management. I did a number of international jobs while I was abroad, working mainly with international development agencies such as CARE, Canada, something called CARE International. There is a CARE US branch, CARE Canada, and CARE Britain and other countries. I was their country representative in Kenya, I think in 1987 to 1990. I also worked for the World University Service of Canada, because Canada had become my adoptive country, and I was their representative in Ethiopia at the height of the famine Emperor Haile Selassie had hidden the fact that there was a serious famine. But one journalist, now dead unfortunately, Mohammed, went in there with cameras, and suddenly around 1984, the news of the famine was brought to the screens, to the television screens of people around the world. Why did I do what I did? When I came, I could have opted for a political career path, because I did occupy very senior positions in the liberation struggle. But I thought there would be enough people to deal with that, and I wanted to focus more on issues of management. When I came back to South Africa, I started working with an NGO, you're familiar with the concept, which was funded by the EU. The aim there was to try and assist rural development communities. There was good funding for that, and the assistance was in the areas of agriculture, educare, which was educating and caring for kids, disadvantaged, environmental management, water reticulation, and things like that. It was a very interesting experience for me, because you had a group of people who had been very active in the struggle and felt that they now deserved to get something back. And it came in the form of this project. But there were serious issues of accountability. people didn't really believe that they needed to be accountable to the donor who sat somewhere in Europe. And essentially, one was saying, they've given you their money, but if you don't want to account to them, let's devise a system in which you can account to the people that you're supposed to be representing, the communities that you're assisting. And in the end, that project really came to an end. The structural relationship between the beneficiaries, which were these organizations, and the resource provider proved to be fundamentally flawed, and so it didn't work. Turnaround, you asked me about the turnaround efforts that I have been involved in, and I think this is really what interests you. When I was recruited into the South African National Parks, there were two things about that were unusual. One was, of course, this being South Africa, I was the first black CEO of the organization, and dealing with a number of conservative conservation professionals who had been placed in the organization as much for their professional skills as for their loyalty to the previous government. So there was a little bit of an issue there which needed to be managed, that needed to be handled. The second and even more important issue was that of a non-conservationist being asked to manage a conservation organization. Conservation people are extremely conservative, and in some instances fairly arrogant. They really believe that they understand the world much more than other people. So that to me was a greater challenge than being black, for instance. But the challenges one found there were, A, that although the national parks looked after so many prime tourist assets, there wasn't much attention being paid to revenue collection, because the government was always there to finance them. That was number one. The second one was that black people had been marginalized, had actually been excluded from visiting these national parks by the apartheid system, which actually made it illegal to visit certain places. You grew up in the States at a time when all these things had gone, but Jim Crow and all of that, the times of Martin Luther King, what you were facing then is what we continue to face until about 15 years ago in South Africa. So the transformation had to do with changing the mindset, getting people to understand that competence more than skin color was of utmost importance in the workplace. But at the same time, as we're doing that, to make those who were coming in, who were being given the opportunity, to understand that they needed to earn the right to work there and to be promoted and be regarded. How did one go about, what was really, what stood out in what I think everybody agreed was the success story in the transformation, the turning around of the South African Park? I think two, three things. In order to be able to collect sufficient revenue, well, number one, the philosophy was that as much as possible, the parks should be able to finance themselves. Not entirely, but they should. An attempt should be made for parks to finance themselves. In other words, conservation had to contribute to its own sustenance. And how did we go about achieving that? We invited the private sector to run, to establish high-end lodges within the carefully selected areas in the park. We invited the private sector also to run some of the retail outlets that were found in the park, and also to manage it was retail outlets, it was accommodation. So they needed to do the... So that was what conservationists always feared, that there would be important somebody who was not a conservationist who would start bringing in commercialization. And the ethos there was that is that parks are sacred. You can't just bring anybody to roam around there. And that commercialization would have the effect of devaluing the parks. You know, it's almost like you'd be having light bulbs and emblems and posters all over, which of course was quite wrong. We then also, a key thing was to get black people to A, be friendly to the park. And there were lots of black communities in the neighborhood who would always be regarded as poachers and therefore would be kept out. So we had to change their attitude and make it friendly towards the park. And really the trick there was to include them in discussions around conservation and give them opportunities to run those who needed to run, who were business-minded, to fix roads, you know, to supply, to do some laundry and services, provide laundry services for the park and all of that. That really changed in a very short period of time attitudes. You had people who had always been very hostile to the park, becoming extremely friendly because they suddenly saw it as a benefit. And the commercial, the accommodation facilities built by the private sector, owned by the government, because this is state land, and leased to them, built by these guys and leased back to them over a period of 20 years, it was later changed to 25, it was a model that also worked like magic. So people would come from all over the world, as they still do now, to pay the top dollar to be in Kruger National Park. But this was all done without crowding out the local people. We never touched the accommodation facilities that were always in the park. Instead, we selected places in areas that were particularly suited to small establishments, no more than 20, 30 people, but where there was wonderful game viewing, etc. When I left National Parks, I'm talking too much, when I left National Parks, really, the government, the public, everybody thought they'd done a good job.
Great. So let me ask you now about when you arrived at Home Affairs and you were appointed as Director General, what you saw as the most important challenges and the things you wanted to address first?
At Home Affairs, the biggest challenge was that of addressing issues of inefficiency, corruption, and of course addressing issues of financial management, and because of the problems that had built up as a result of the mismanagement, to also restore staff morale so that we could have happy people working in the park. Those are really the key challenges.
And so I've heard a lot about the strategy of quick wins in the department. Can you describe how you decided which things to focus on for quick wins?
The The quick wins had to do with doing things that would convince the public that there was change happening. Things that you could do quite quickly, that for which you didn't need to invest too much money, too much time, and too much in the form of resources, too many people. And these were things like business process re-engineering. We took a look at why it took so long to produce an ID, identity document. And when I arrived there, on average, really, you got your ID after 137 days. And we looked at why that was happening. That didn't require money. It required people who understood business processes to cut out those loops that you didn't need. And not only would this quicken the time, but it would also cut out some of the corruption, because as these documents went round and round, they got into too many hands. I'm sure you may have been told that the 127 days it took to produce an ID involved 80 handlings of the document from the beginning of the application to the time when somebody got their ID. These were cut down to no more than 15. We needed and got really good business process experts, and in no time we had taken the number down. We targeted 60 days within which to produce an ID. And we achieved that. And in the second year, we're down to about 40. So, and that didn't require too much investment of money and time. So that was one of the quick wins. But also, while this was pioneered by experts, the trick was to get at the end of each day the group of people who are working on a particular aspect of ID production to sit and review the work they've done and plan what they will do tomorrow. And before they started doing anything the following day, they checked the score, so to say, and they started making comparisons over time and began to try and understand why there were loops in productivity. And all of that was carefully taken down, written down, and it would be fed back to the people. And there were incentives given, not in the form of recognition. A board went up to say so-and-so did his fingerprints in such and such a period of time. This day, so-and-so scanned 1,200. So there you had an increase, I think, of about more than 100%. But the recognition motivated people, and the education on how to evaluate your work and plan better. And it was really more a question of planning that assisted very much. So that was a real quick turnaround as far as the ID is concerned. Then of course what we also did, some of this took time. We looked at contracting. South Africa has got a vast distribution network. We would at the time would hire the company that would collect applications from various offices and take them to a head office in Pretoria. And there was a different company that took documents back from Pretoria to the different places. We said, no, why can't we use the same company? We get to know them better, And the turnaround, literal turnaround, can be calculated in terms of you collected and you delivered back. What did the whole cycle do? The other thing that we measured was the other thing that we did was to change the payment system to these couriers. As long as the office that was as long as the field office hired the courier to do this, they would quite naturally want to conserve on funds, and they wouldn't want them to go back with a bag that was half full. So the tendency was to wait until the bag of applications was full before paying money to allow the courier to take the staff to have it full. So we said, forget about that. Efficiency is much more important in this case than cost. So we centralized the payment of this. And so those guys didn't bother how many times these people came. In fact, they wanted them to come as frequently as possible, because we then also introduced competition and the results would be published. This is the office that did the best. This is the province that has done the best. And this is, these are laggards, you know, who are lagging behind us. So little things like that really enabled a transformation to take place really without too much investment in money and in time. And that's how we achieved some of the turnaround.
And to what extent did you apply things that you'd learned from the national parks in this process in home affairs? Was it very different, or were there some of the same principles at play?
It's a very different environment, but I think it's more a question of the attitude to managing people, the relationship between the managers and the managed, if you will. For people to delegate as much as possible, I've always believed in decentralization of decision-making, so that the people closest to the place where a decision must be made, which is the field, are empowered sufficiently to be able to take that decision. And you just monitor how it's performed and then put in the necessary curbs if it became necessary to ensure that the thing was done successfully and without any violation. That was one. The other was to decentralization went together with empowerment. So, but also, yes, you needed to give people confidence that they could do things. It's delegation. Yeah?
How do you go about giving people that kind of confidence?
Oh, yeah. Well, we would hold discussion groups, workshops, and we would sit around a table, and I, as the CEO, would sit with 10 or 9, 8 people, and we would find out how they saw the job, the challenges, how they related. You know, I would give them the assurance every time that, guys, I would like you to be as free as possible in expressing yourself. I want to guarantee you upfront that anybody who criticizes management, including myself, will not be fired. I want to repeat this. I know I'm not always going to be able to defend you from others who might find an excuse from firing you, but please understand this. Feel free to criticize me. You will not be fired as a result of it. So that gave people the confidence to speak out, to be free, to criticize constructively. I mean, there would always be a mix of people who are not serious and the ones who are serious. Say, but you know, we don't understand why management does things like this, that, and the other. We could easily take this approach. And so when people started really coming out, I remember a guy, I'm talking about home affairs now, he said, you know, you've got people standing in lines here. what would it cost to put a screen, a television screen there, that tells people, let's see, that plays music so that people are entertained while they're here. Just play some music. And let's do some good signage. A lot of people only discover when they get to the counter that they are looking, you find that they're looking for, they're coming only for information. So if we told them where the information desk is, they would go there, find that, and go away. So a lot of these things didn't come from experts or from head office. They came from people who were there. I think once they gained the confidence, once you sat with them and shared a drink with them, in the evening it also was so important when we got together, maybe with the people who we would be traveling with from head office, and we just sit and talk about our lives, and I tell them about who I am without, you know, overwhelming them with anything. And then they say, but you ask about their family lives and so on, sensitively and so on. And people would just open up and really feel that they were taken seriously, cared for and so on. I think that really plays a big role. And I found that to work in whichever institution I work. I really end up being more of a threat to managers than to the people on the ground.
And is that something that you partly learned from roles in this, that you had in the struggle?
I think some of it, yes, the struggle was a great leveler. You must know that when we sat outside, it was people with degrees, with good education, with no education, and everybody was together in a camp, and you got to know and respect people's individual capabilities. Some of the commanders are guys with very little school, but because they had courage and they would go to the field and lead, they could read maps and they were courageous. They earned that respect. I learned that education is a wonderful thing, but it's not the be-all in determining the character in determining leadership. When we went into dangerous areas, nobody asked whether you had a degree or not. It was, will that guy go to the trenches there? And so I really learned to have a great, great deal of respect for character, just for ordinary people. And so I don't know whether some of it is my own nature. I think I'm blessed with not being too complicated about or impressed by things. I respect people's achievements, qualifications and so on, but I think I'm lucky to really relate very, very well with ordinary people. As I say, sometimes my relationship with the people on the ground tends to be a bit of a threat, as people think, are you likely to undermine us by going down to talk to the people? I say, no, the principles of management are very clear. I talk to the people and so on. So I think that, as I see it, that's how it works.
So did you do a lot of actually going among people lower down in the department and motivating them?
I don't think in any of the jobs that I've done, anyone visited the field more than I did. It was very, I think at one time we calculated that I was achieving about 48% of my time out in the field, which was a lot really, because it's not easy in these institutions. There are meetings, you are accountable to superiors, you want internal meetings with stakeholders, meeting with government who is your shareholder. It's a lot. It's easy not to be in the field. So I really always attach a lot of value in going to talk to the people on the ground. And that's what they would say about me if you were to ask them about what style of management you have.
And what sorts of things did you do when you went into the field to talk to people?
It was always, it's motivation. You're kind of talking about home affairs. which is a very difficult environment because of its association with incompetence, with corruption, etc. And you'd say to the guys something like, you know, if we could turn this thing around, we would be the most popular people in South Africa. Can you imagine? Everybody in this country and those who visit at one time or another must come to our office. You know, we are privileged to serve people and give them birth certificates. It's really a privilege that they must come to you and I write and put my name onto a birth certificate and to a marriage certificate. The ID is issued there. And can you imagine, with all the difficulties that people are experiencing, if you were just to say to somebody, you'll get your passport, your ID, in 2 weeks, and not in 6 or 8 weeks. You know, that kind of service, the satisfaction that you get as an individual is marvelous. It gives me great kicks as a person to do that. Does it, and you'll find that people will then strive to achieve those things. I think it's motivation and giving people making people believe in themselves that they can achieve those things, but also really treating them always with respect. And what I always used to say to people is that I don't look at the watch when it comes to managing you. Because I would say I've seen so-and-so. I've seen the light in his office at 7 o'clock in the evening when I left here. I'm not going to go and see when he got to the office in the morning. I assume that responsible people work for as long as they need to or when it's necessary. And if you've got problems at home, let's respect procedures. But I don't expect a manager to say you can't go home to fix a problem because it's working time, because they never stop you when you stay overtime and not even claim overtime. You know, that kind of recognition that really makes them feel appreciated.
So that actually brings up another area that I'm interested in, which is absenteeism in the department. And I've heard that it's been reduced quite a lot, at least in some parts of the department, and I wondered how you think that's been done.
Again, it's really, well, I think we can still go much further to reduce absenteeism, but a significant reduction has occurred. It must have to do with a variety of things. Number one, people start to love their job when they go to the office and feel that it's worthwhile being there because you are saying they are serving the public and they feel part of that. That they are appreciated makes a lot of difference. That they are regarded as adults, as people who can think on their own. When you say, I'm not as a leader, I'm really more of a coordinator. You know what's supposed to be done. I exist merely to make sure that the different units have some kind of synergy in their tool, but not to tell you what you know, because you know it better than me. I think it's that kind of motivation that assists an organization get its people there. But I'll tell you one thing, we are a rather big organization, and we've been steeped in negative culture for a very long time. I must say reluctantly that there are people who just want change, not because they can't change, but because they really see no value in change. They do have an influence on others, particularly if you don't get quickly up to speed in terms of dispensing justice, whether it's in the form of disciplining people who are not, you know, performing well, because otherwise people wonder why they have to do so much, and at the end of the day, everybody is paid similarly. So I think when people do something that is wrong, it is important that they are seen to be chastised. And it's not as if you must always be handing out. I think stick is important, but so is carrot. But stick really comes right at the tail end. But when you've talked to people and it's quite clear that they will not change, then in the interest of the organization, then you must find a way of moving them out. Yeah. And fairness also goes a long way towards motivating people. I've had managers who are very strict and whom you would think a little on the rough side. But I've had those they supervise saying, but he's very fair. I think he believes that he's fair. He's not doing this against me. And that goes a long way.
How do you reconcile this kind of consultative leadership with the very specific targets that were set for people in various stages of
the It's the consultative leadership that produces results. It is. That's what you agree in the morning. I mean, consultative versus authoritarian, you could yell out an instruction via an email or barking it in the morning and say, I want this thing to be reached and so on. And maybe people will do that, but they may not do it with as much happiness as if you come round from time to time. Hey guys, do you seem to be, looks like we might not be able to make it today. What's happening and so on. You know, always encouraging rather than saying, why, it's 3 o'clock and we are still here. Why have you done? I think it's the consultative approach. Why do you think you didn't make it yesterday? For 15 minutes the power supply was down for this. Whereas if you didn't really seek to understand what the problems are, you could easily come to a wrong conclusion.
Something I've been very interested in is how people have accepted the target set for them, which, depending on the context, could seem very demanding, and whether people have presented resistance.
Yeah, but you agree collectively on the target. You don't dictate it. And you agree based on some experience. I mean, you do your trial runs and find that people achieve, you know, higher targets than what they had been doing, and you say, okay guys, I think it's possible to do. Shall we all commit to do 800 instead of 600? And the people say, no, we can do that. Sometimes they even suggest, no, I think we can do 1,000. Say, no, no 1,000, I don't want any failure. Let's keep it at such and such a place. We will look at it in a week again and see whether we can go to 1,000 or not. And they find that sometimes 1,000 is difficult, but they feel that they have participated. This figure has not, this number has not been imposed on them. It's really the participation, the getting it out of the group. I think it does the trick. So, yes, the targets did not come from somewhere, from head office. No one said, guys, ideas ought to be done in 30 days. In fact, we've said to people, you know, in an ideal world, you should be able to produce your ID in about 2-3 days. But we are a country that is diverse, that's got distances, that is underdeveloped in this manner or the other. So let's look at something that's realistic, etc. And they discuss and accept that. I mean, the short answer is I don't think it's difficult to achieve a target that people have themselves identified and agreed as necessary and achievable. A lot of the time, almost all the time. You would impose a higher target if you are dealing with a demotivated group. And that happens sometimes. And you deal, if there is a group there, the competition too is very important, you know, if you are able to achieve it. If you have a group that's achieving 800 and another that's achieving 700, you say, why is it they can do it? And find a way of motivating high level. So it's incentive. Thank you guys, you did a good job. I know you can do it, you're coming up with this thing. You can't be beaten by that group. Competition and so on.
And to what extent were you personally involved in discussions like that?
Very much so. When I was claiming a little earlier that I do not think that there is a CEO or a DG who visited the field more than I did, my claim is absolutely correct. Contact with the people at the lowest level is absolutely vital for their morale. Absolutely. I was personally involved, but of course you must understand that you are not the organization. There is a need to build a team.
Can you describe how you went about building a team?
You know, you identify some good guys. You know, we are differently skilled, differently gifted. And as you sit in meetings and discuss, you find out who has what strengths in what things. And you deploy those people appropriately in places where you think they can optimize on their skills. But you get people to accept that this is teamwork. But you also get them to buy into the philosophy that you lead, and I may be wrong here, but I think the results prove, at least in a limited fashion otherwise. I would say to people, it's sheer coincidence that I'm the leader. It could have been you, you know. If you cast this thing through the die, it pointed to me as a leader. I have a master's degree. Three or four of you have master's degrees too. So really, yes, maybe I've been older than many people. I may be older than you. So strictly speaking, there is nothing in me as myself that singles me out as leadership. So I'm not going to expect you to do less than I do. You are as capable as I am in some instances. In some cases, some of you are more capable than me. And the other principle that I always use is that guys, don't be territorial, don't be insecure. Give the people you manage space to do things, to shine. And I always say to them, when they shine and produce results, the credit will come to me, because I'm in charge. So if you are working with a unit there which performs exceptionally well, don't worry that they will be saying, John is doing well. And they'll say, wow, that guy's unit is doing well. So the kudos come to you. And you repeat this more and more, and people start relaxing. And actually, you would be amazed in this scenario how much people actually hog the work and prevent people from coming in, because that might show them off as not terribly good, you know. The brilliant, your brilliance, if you work for me, is I am so comfortable with you. It doesn't matter that somebody comes and says, gee, Mavuzo is the CEO, but that guy's much wiser. It's okay. When we publish results and when people talk about my institution, they say, I've achieved things. So that's good. That's good for me. And I acknowledge, that's another one. published. When people say, wow, you guys have turned it around and so on, I say, you know, I don't think it would have happened without that guy. You know, he pushed it and so on. And I'll be speaking in the media, to the media. One outstanding fellow here who actually came up with the solution was so and so. I tell you, we would still be so far behind and so on. And this is telling the public. And people help. Feel...
Thanks.
So it's so simple.
Right. What sorts of measures have you put in place to ensure that these changes will be sustainable?
Well, it's very difficult. I must confess that I am not always sure that it will be sustainable. If you're talking about the Department of Home Affairs, I'm ending my term shortly. It will have been a 3-year term. I think you need much longer than that to build capacity, to build confidence. And my hope is really that the foundation that has been laid can be built on by others. And if those who come after us don't have the same attitude to the people, don't enjoy the same confidence, then there is always a risk that things could fall back. I saw it happening with CETA, with the state, from the national parks I went to run the state IT agency, CETA. And the government wanted to close the institution down because of the ineptitude, the corruption, the inefficiency. In 3 years, government said, wow, they started giving us big contracts, big projects to implement. The industry, the IT industry, started saying, wow, that's what you should be doing, you guys. Don't compete with us. Facilitate our access within control, within a controlled environment to government business. And then also, the turnaround in tenders. Again, it would take 100 plus days to complete the adjudication of a tender. And we took it down to 70 and so on, which is a reasonable period of time. Actually, the most efficient, given the periods that you must give time, people time to complete. So, unfortunately, and this is an issue of leadership. When I left the state IT agency after 4 years, the board was very hesitant, indecisive. And there are some very good people within management, at least two of them, could have taken over my job, and I have no doubt that one of them at least would have done much better than me. I'm not being falsely modest and so on, because he was well grounded in management and in finance, and he also had a strong IT background. For some reason, I don't know whether they were looking for politically accepted people or whatever it is they were looking for. They started losing these people. The institution is ailing now. It is in the intensive care unit. So, I'm not gonna shout too prematurely about having laid a foundation for sustainability. National Parks is one institution where succession was very good. The guy who used to run Kruger Park took over from me. Kruger Park is the biggest of all the national parks we have here. And he's kept it, and it's going higher and higher. I'm very happy with that. I'm very proud of that. I'm not proud of what has happened to the other institutions. And Home Affairs, I think, I'm not sure. I think a lot more work. It's a big institution with over 7,000 people. We really need more time. And what shall I say, because you are a researcher? I think it's also, there are some flaws in the structure of and the distribution of responsibilities at executive and management level. It doesn't quite work like in the private sector, where the director general is CEO and the minister is chairman, non-executive chairman. The minister is invested with a lot of power that goes right into the responsibilities of a CEO. For instance, the appointment of people at the top level is the responsibility of the minister. So you can imagine a CEO who is given, well, all things going well, there is good participation and agreement on who should be appointed, etc. But where that doesn't happen, and I've seen it not happen, you end up managing people that you really don't like because you don't think they're okay. But the power to appoint at that level vests in the minister. So there's a built-in conflict right there, which is really anathema to good management. The other thing, of course, is that government, this was the first direct government. I've been in public institutions, but not right in government. And the rules, the regulations are sometimes work, a lot of the time work against efficiency. The standardization, for instance, in the hierarchical setup of a government department. Any government department will have a DG, a DDG, a chief director, a director, a deputy director, an assistant director. And by the time you come to normal people, there's this whole pile of people sitting on top. Now, some of the departments manage agriculture, but others manage information and documents like us. You can do with a very, very flat structure, for instance, in Home Affairs, but I guess it wouldn't be very easy for an institution of government, or a department of government. I suppose it's much easier to standardize and make things like that, and there are costs to doing that. People don't look at the function. Some are policy-oriented, like developing education syllabi, standards and so on. But others are operational, like the Department of Home Affairs, which must be out there giving out IDs, birth certificates and so on. So you can't really manage them, strictly speaking, with the same kind of stuff. Something suffers if you standardize.
Great. Well, I know we're running out of time, so thanks so much. Is there anything else you'd like to add before
I
start?
Well, I mean, I just respond to the questions. I can't think of anything. It's end of the day. I'm a little tired, but thank you for the interest in what you do.
Thank you.